This week's conversation with Ann Beck is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org and Sassy Jack Stitchery at sassyjackstitchery.com. The 2024 EGA National Seminar is over, which means that we get to see the projects that will be offered at the 2025 seminar. Watch the EGA website in the coming days to see what might entice you to attend the 2025 event, which will be Needlework Fair 2025 and held November 12 to 16 in Dallas. Between now and then, there's much for EGA members to explore and do. One of the most popular offerings is the virtual lecture series. The next lecture is Measuring Millimeters on a Napoleonic Era Dress Coat with Liz Tapper. The lecture date is Saturday, September 14 at 1 p.m. Eastern. Registration opens August 19 at 1 p.m. Eastern. Remember that the code FIBERTALK5, that's FIBERTALK and the number 5, will get you your next lecture, live or recorded, for free. And of course, if you're not already a member, join the EGA at egausa.org. There's still some summer left and all of fall, so plan a trip to visit the new Sassy Jack store in the Smoky Mountains. It's a great place to visit in the middle of some great tourist towns and artist communities. The mountain area is beautiful any time of the year, but combining the fall colors with a trip to shop and stitch at Sassy Jack's can make a great weekend with stitching friends. You'll also want to monitor the Sassy Jack's website or the Facebook page for an upcoming workshop with Jackie DePlessis. The workshop, Fall Bounty, will be held in early November. The Sassy Jack's Fall Soiree will be the next virtual event. It will be held October 26. Thanks to EGA and Sassy Jacks for sponsoring the show, and now our conversation with the talented embroidery artist, Ann Beck. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from San Francisco, Ann Beck. Ann, welcome.
Thank you, Gary and Beth. Nice to be here and so pleased.
Thanks for doing this because we got questions.
We've been drooling over your work for, I have at least, for quite a while, your Instagram posts.
Yep. Same here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thank you. Actually,
let's do this in reverse because I've got questions about your whole theater and costume thing, but let's talk about your embroidery first. So a career in the theater, costume, professional ice skating, all of that. And then at some point you just say, enough, I'm going to do embroidery. Where does that transition happen?
Well, I've done embroidery all of my life. And I did incorporate a lot of embroidery into my costume designing, but more applique embroidery because there just isn't a budget to do a huge amount of hand embroidery. In theatrical work, maybe in the movies there is, but just because of the time it takes. And I loved working in the theater. I loved designing costumes. I worked, with some of the top ballet companies and top figure skaters in the world. But it's a very stressful career and people never realize quite how stressful it is. The artistic end of it is wonderful. Just really enjoyed that. And I love being in the theater, but the deadlines, trying to keep all your people employed in between jobs or having to work 80 hours a week for a couple months without stop, because you have to take the work when it's there. It just started to take a toll on me. And so I, after having been a costume designer and owning a costume shop in San Francisco for about, I guess, well, I owned a shop here for about 12 years, but I was designing for about 15 years. I just finally decided I had to stop. So I closed my business. And now my artistic endeavors are geared towards hand embroidery, and I just started doing it again because I love it so much. And, you know, I've always felt in my head, if I could make money, enough money to live on just doing hand embroidery, well, that would be wonderful. But realistically, in
the United stand in States, line for that. Yeah.
Particularly in San Francisco, that's just completely impossible. So, yeah. So I've been doing it just for myself. And during the pandemic had so much extra time, as did everybody, I guess. And it also was a way to sort of de-stress and fill my time. And so I really started doing it much more regularly and just began to have these ideas in my head. I've made some beautiful things for my family. And this piece that I've been working on, Nightbirds, I actually designed for myself. I never intended to make it a teaching piece or to sell it. But it began to get a lot of attention, as I sort of progressed on it.
But before you go any further, since we have some video, it's right there behind you.
Yes, it is.
Go get it. Let's see it. Let's talk
about
it.
Oh, it's huge. You want me to bring it over? Really?
Sure. Why not?
Yes, okay, please.
It's a little large. Yeah. I'm not sure you can see it in the camera here. Let's see.
When she says large, I wanted to see what she meant by large. Oh, yes, that is.
Oh, it's pretty large. So let's see. I need to send it that way. Whoa. And
It's every bit what the pictures show. Yep.
Oh, it is gorgeous. I just love the colors. It glows. It glows.
So, yeah. Well, there are a lot of beads, and I'm sorry, it's heavy. I'm trying to keep it in the middle there. But it's got a lot of Austrian crystals in it. It's got a lot of vintage sequins and beads. I collect beautiful vintage little metal micro beads, like from the late 19th century, very early 20th century for use in my work. And, you know, as a costume designer, I was always collecting when I would see gorgeous, unusual things. For the last 30 years, I've collected things. So anyway, so it is, and it has a lot of gold. You can't see the gold as well, I don't think, on the screen here, but there's a lot of gold work in it and silk threads. It's on a silk velvet background. And I don't know if it'll sparkle if I move it. The lights I have here aren't really.
Oh, yeah, there it is. There it is. Sure.
It should be a little sparkly. Anyway, so, and it's about 10 inches square right now. And this part of it is finished. And as you can see, there's a lot of extra fabric around the outside, the silk velvet. And I am going to put about a 1.5 to 2 inch wide goldwork border around the whole piece, which I haven't designed yet, but it'll be probably fairly geometric, but use some of the elements from the center vignette, but mostly goldwork and sequins with a little bit of color in the threads, things, something. Yep.
Okay, put it back before you drop it. Now I have more questions. See, that's the trouble.
Yeah, that is the problem. And I keep thinking, okay, so you're a magpie. You collect beads and sparkly things.
I do.
Oh, good.
Yes,
I do too.
Sparkly things. Yeah, doesn't have sparkles on it, I'm not happy. So,
and for people who are listening, this will be the lead photo in everything that we post. So, for a lot of obvious reasons, so you won't miss out. All right, questions. Okay, now, Beth and I have been making noise time and time again about using slate frames, and we have slate frames, and we keep threatening to set them up, and we have one set up, and it's just a whole thing that just never gets anywhere. You've got a piece of black cloth. What you said, that was velvet?
It's actually not black. It looks black maybe in the screen here. It's a deep sapphire blue silk velvet.
Okay, that's mounted on
it's
a ground.
Mounted on calico, which is like muslin, but it's from England. It's a much higher quality type of muslin than it's really you can generally find in the US. So it's mounted on the backing because just stretching the silk velvet is much too thin to support this type of embroidery. So that backing gives it a stability. And this slate frame was custom made for me. I had it custom made in England by Jenny Adding Christie's company. So it's a gorgeous slate frame, which was made specially for this project.
We have, we both have two sets of Jenny Adding Christie slate frames. Yes.
Mine's sitting next to me waiting to be loaded. So, but now you've given me an idea because mine is, that's my problem. I have a piece and it's linen, but I'm afraid that it, if I put it, the linen on the slate frame, it's going to distort my linen. It's not, it's printed. It's a little bit of a different weave.
It depends on the fabric, obviously, but if it's a high quality, high thread count linen, and is the if it's just thread that you're stitching on it, not heavy like gold work and stuff,
I would be putting gold work on it.
So it depends how heavy the linen is. Then, if it just has a little bit of gold work, but you might be okay just with the fabric. If it has a lot, you may want to mount it. But generally, the important thing is first of all to make sure your fabric is on grain. I always mark the grain lines, top to bottom and across, on my warp and weft on the frame, the backing fabric as well as the fabric you're going to be embroidering on, so that you make sure you get it on really straight. And then if the tension is done well, usually you don't have a problem. I think slate frames are a lot easier. Well, they're not easiest to set up, but they're a lot easier to set up than many people imagine they will be. So.
Yeah. I think it's just the time. It's taking the time to sit there and say, okay.
It took 4 days to set this one up, but that's extreme because it's very large. The frame is 36 inches by 24 inches. It didn't take me 4 days to stretch it because I'm including transferring the design onto the fabric, which took a long time. So, but the stretching maybe was like a day for this, day and a half. And it's important too to stretch your frame in advance of when you want to start it working on it, so you can let it sit because the cording stretches a little bit. Sometimes the fabric will relax a little bit, and then you need to tighten it up a little bit more before you begin your embroidery. So,
that's good to know.
There's a little tip. Yeah, that helps.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So you've got the velvet mounted on the calico. How is that attached?
It's just a hand cross stitch. So I mount the calico and I make it not super tight but taut. You know, so it's not saggy at all. And then I put the velvet on, and I've marked. I go ahead and just draw a straight grain line across the calico, and then I've got my center both top to bottom and side to side marked on my ground fabric, so I can line it up, and then just I pin it first, make sure there are no wrinkles and that it's fairly, you know, nicely spread out. Some people actually. You can connect the two fabrics together with an adhesive or I don't like that because I use, this is velvet and it would have kind of messed up the velvet to do that. But I often use silk taffeta. And if you attach that with a glue or like a web adhesive, it takes some of the beauty of the silk away because it just changes it slightly and I don't like it. Okay. So I don't do that. But it is possible. There's another thing that you might be able to use that I used to use when I was a costume designer, and it's a spray. I can't remember the exact name of it. You can get it at most sewing stores, and it's a tacky spray that allows you to sort of put something on temporarily, and then you can stitch it, and eventually the tackiness goes away, so you don't have to wash it out or whatever.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right. We learned things. I knew we would learn things.
Yes.
All right. Back to when you shut down your business, a huge mental release for you?
It was difficult. Yeah, it was very difficult. But I felt like if I didn't do something else, that I was actually having stress-related illness from the stress, to the point that I felt like if I continued, I was going to have a heart attack by the time I was, 45 or 50. So it really was, I decided it was important. It was difficult to leave, and the people that I worked for were just stunned. A lot of people were stunned and like, what are we going to do? But, they've all gone on and managed. So,
No, we've talked to more than one person who operated in that world and then left it. And I think the one thing, that message that we got from each one was, at some point the stress on all fronts just gets to be too
much. It's very difficult. Yeah. And I mean, I worked in the theater. If you work in TV or film, oh my gosh, it's even worse, because you're basically on call 24/7 all the time. Yeah. Whenever they need, and sometimes they need things right away. And it's, I did a little bit of TV work, but it wasn't like a weekly television show. Those are the ones that are super, I mean, things are different now than when I was working, but that's very stressful. So, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously it's tough to leave people behind when you're running a business. I can't, they're depending on their jobs, and to just shut that off, that's tough. But for you, in terms of your creativity, I'm sure there was a couple of weeks or three where it was just de-stress. And then do you feel your creativity just take off for you?
To be honest, I'll tell you, I actually opened another business, which I haven't talked about. I actually own a Pilates studio in San Francisco, because I'd been doing Pilates to de-stress, and it helped me so much. I actually got certified to teach Pilates, which is about the polar opposite from costume design. So I still own a Pilates studio in San Francisco, but in all my free time, I do embroidery all the time, which is how I keep my creative artistic side alive. You can sort of see I'm starting to turn it into a business, and hopefully when I'm ready to retire from teaching Pilates, which I do enjoy, but then I'll be able to turn this into more of a business. So yeah, theater and fashion too, it's very hard. So. Yeah.
Okay. So you found your paths to get the tension out of your body then. Okay.
That's good. That's good.
That's terrific. So then with your embroidery, I mean, you have so many techniques in there in just that one, and that isn't the only one that you've done. I mean, are you still working out what your look and your path is in terms of what you stitch? Or
No, I think I have a very recognizable style already, and it goes back to my style as a costume designer. I mean, it's different because it's hand embroidery, I always like learning new techniques and things, but I have a pretty recognizable style already, and it, all the designs I do always go back to this sort of swirling, circular patterns. I love sort of floral type elements, leaves, vines. The birds, when I was a girl, I used to draw fantastical birds, just doodle them all the time. So that's sort of where that comes from. But when I decide to design something, I do a lot of research. It comes out of my head. But then, like, I decide I want some flowers. I look at flower pictures. I look at bird pictures. And even though I don't use them as they are in nature, and in fact, this is has a lot of elements of crewel work in it, the style of this particular one, which I haven't done before, it still has the sort of elements of nature in it that I enjoy. And then I stylize things. Everything is always very stylized, even if I do research on specific things that exist in the world already. So.
Okay. So nature gives you the starting point, and then you go from there.
I think so. Yeah. I sometimes don't know where these things came from. Nightbirds just sort of started to run around in my head and was there for a while. And then it sort of started coming out as some quick sketches, and took several months But anyway, here it is.
Yeah. Okay. So that's how. So then that's how it happens. Then is you, an idea that you just start scribbling on paper and just it just kind of forms and evolves then.
Well, it forms in my mind first, and I usually think about it for quite some time. I begin to have very sort of specific images. And then, like the first drawing of Nightbirds I did, you would laugh. I don't have it here to show it to you, but you would laugh if you saw it. It was just, it's just like really messy scribbles, you know, sort of. I just take like what's in my mind and I quick scribble draw it. And so it had sort of the shape and the elements, but just a mess. And then I slowly begin to work on proportion. I slowly begin to work on each element to make it specific. Then I start doing studies for each element, drawing studies, until I get the drawing to a point where it's each element is fairly close to what it may be when I'm finished. And I work on the proportion, like adjusting proportion little by little. Sometimes I even cut my paper and move it. You know, there at the beginning, I'll retrace the drawing, but eventually I start just shifting the pieces in the drawing that I have until I come to something that's fairly finished. So I know many people think you just sit down and draw what you're going to do, but that's not how it works. I mean, I worked on this drawing probably for 3 months before I actually put it onto paper and painted it in color. So.
Yeah. See, that's the part that I love to hear is all those things that make it come together in the end. So it really is a process of adjustment and, modification all the way through, and then you say you paint it. So
yes, actually here I can show you, actually it's over here, I can show you. So this is the I didn't paint it fully. Let's see if I can get that in the center. There we go. That this is okay. So it's a partially pencil sketch and partially, which way do I need to move it? There we go.
You're fine.
Okay. So partially a pencil sketch and then partially painted in gouache, which is an opaque watercolor. It takes a very long time to do the color rendering. And so I got to the point where I just needed to see what the elements of the color were going to be in each sort of space. And once I sort of knew then what it was going to look like, I didn't finish the whole thing because I didn't want to spend another, you know, however many hours doing it. I wanted to start on the embroidery. But that's where I go. I always do it in color first. I can show you this. We haven't talked about yet, but I am going to be teaching a workshop in France based on Nightbirds in 2025.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that because we've been looking into that. Yeah.
this is the design for the kit for that. So it's based on Nightbirds. It has the bluebird, the big pink and red flower. And then I took the buds and put more of those. So it's going to be when it's finished and it's on, it will be on a blue silk, not a velvet, but a blue silk taffeta. And so it's going to look have the same feel, and all the crystals and beads, which I don't paint those. It's just too hard to paint them all. But it'll have the same feel as Nightbirds, but it's smaller and manageable for people to do themselves. So Nightbirds, to get it to where it is now, it was somewhere between 900 and 1,000 hours. so I estimate it will be, when it's finished, maybe about 200 hours to finish it. So so it's still an extensive kit. It'll be a kind of high intermediate to advanced kit, but that's what they wanted. So I had never intended to turn it into a kit, but Nadine and Mark, Nadine Rogers, who runs Creative Experiences, which is the company that's hiring me to teach in France. She wanted something based on Nightbirds. So I said, okay, why not? So I'm game.
Okay. Hold that thought. So then from those paintings, then that tells me that you're painting just enough so that your mind says, all right, I get it. Now get the threads out and let's have at it.
Yes. Well, the kit one I did fully. I painted it fully so that they use it for publicity and things like that.
Right.
But the other one, yes, I just needed to paint enough so that I knew what it was going to look like. And then I went ahead and started designing the embroidery, because that's the second or maybe third phase of the design, is that I actually have to decide, okay, these are the colors. Now, what are the elements that are going to go into this embroidery? What are the stitches? What beads? What crystals? And I, you know, I pull out, I have hundreds, probably thousands of beads and crystals and various metal elements in my cabinets and drawers and various things. And so I start pulling things out. I get my, I have the Auvergne-Rhône color card, which if you want to design, it's very important to have a color card for the threads that you want to use, because they're never the same online. And I start matching, color matching. And that's a whole, that's another long process. And sometimes I don't have what I want. And so I have to start searching for it online. You know, I order things off Etsy. I order things from Europe. I order a lot, all my gold work from England. I've ordered some gold work stuff from Spain. I've just ordered some things from Germany. You know, so I search worldwide, which is something I did obviously as a costume designer. So I know how to do that. But when I'm looking for something in particular, then I search until I find it, basically. So,
okay. So that,
so do you,
go ahead, Beth. I'm hogging all the time. Sorry.
So do you audition, like, especially like the beads and the sequins and all those elements, do you audition them somehow before you place them on your?
In fact, because the bird for this, in my mind, I had this idea of what it was going to look like, and it was so complex. I tried painting it with the beads, and it just was not successful. And so I actually did a full sample of the bird and the pink flower and some of the leaves and vines, which is not something I usually do because it takes a really long time. But I did that, and I'm glad that I did it, because it made me realize some changes that I wanted to make, some things I liked, some things I didn't like. And so then I changed it before I started working on the final piece. And about auditioning the elements, yes, I get my needle nose, I have these bent tip needle nose pliers, and I get all my crystals and my little tiny micro beads out, and I start placing them on the fabric and placing them with the gold work elements and little things and sort of seeing how things are going to look. I love metal sequins too. I have a collection of, again, they're from the 19th century, but they're metal sequins, and particularly in blues, the colors look very different than a blue that is just made today. I mean, you can get beautiful sequins that are made in France that are currently made, and I use those as well. What is it, Langlois Martin, I think, but the vintage ones they have a certain different look that I like. So
you're as much a collector as a designer and embroiderer than it sounds like.
Yes, because without collecting the things, you don't know what's out there. For me, one of the most exciting moments was when I found that a store that I used to go to in Manhattan whenever I was there, it's called Tinsel Trading. They have the largest do you know it?
I do, yes.
It's the most wonderful, wonderful store. And it dates back to the early part of the 20th century. I think the woman who owns it now, her grandfather initially started it. And they have every kind of metal thread, vintage. They have vintage things. There are many things from the 1930s, 40s. Anyway, that store is now in Berkeley, California, because they couldn't afford the rent out in Manhattan anymore. And she had friends out here, so she moved out. And so I was so excited when I found that out. Anyway.
But I was going to ask you if you knew her. I was going to ask you if you knew about her, because I was like, she just had that sale where she had all those beautiful sequined, they were appliques, and they were just gorgeous. I was like, okay, don't look at those, Beth.
I don't know each other personally. I mean, I think I've met her, and we've corresponded. You know, when I was in the costume business, nobody had websites. So if I wanted, you know, sometimes you need like gold bullion fringe for something for San Francisco Ballet. And where do? You call Tinsel Trading and say, hey, I need this gold bullion fringe for this belt or whatever, or tie, sash. Can you send me a few samples? And I mean, if you're in the trade, they back then would have sent me some samples. And then I would call back and say, okay, I want number 5 and number 10, you know, 20 yards or whatever. And because that was the only place to get that kind of thing. You can get it in Europe, obviously, and you can get it in England, newly made now. But back then I didn't have access to that because you couldn't just Google it and find it. If you didn't know where it was made, but anyway, so they were the one company in the U.S. that had it, had those kind of things.
Couldn't afford rent in New York, so moved to Berkeley. Okay.
There you go. She had some other reasons too. I don't really know her, but anyway. So.
I assume she had other reasons because I can't imagine that was any cheaper rent-wise.
Well, who knows, but.
But yeah, yay for you, because that's just right down the road then, effectively. Yeah. Are you concerned about gold work availability, threads, and those kinds of things? I mean, it seems to me like that whole industry is just on the edge all the time in terms of.
I have been able to get what I want so far. But you're right. It could be a dying thing. I mean, I use Benton and Johnson gold work mostly now, which is made in England. And I think in England they have a large, there's the churches, the royal house, obviously the coronation probably put every embroiderer in England to work, and probably bought every bit of really high, the real gold work, the 2% gold that probably was available. But, so it is a concern, I guess, but so far I've been able to get what I want. And, in Spain too, it's supported a lot by the churches. It's, for a normal person, it's almost impossible to get the stuff from Spain unless you go there. I think I had to jump through hoops to find what I wanted and get it ordered. But but it is possible. So, but there are companies. I mean, in England, a number of the women or the people that are selling beautiful embroidery kits also sell the gold work supplies. And there are some companies in the U.S. I think. Thistle Threads on the East Coast. I can't think of her last name right now, but Trisha sells gold work. There are, some places. There's a lady in Canada. They're not a lot, but it is around. I mean, it's obviously a lot of the colored stuff is made in India too. You can find it on Etsy. There's a place in Michigan, Garibaldi. Is it Garibaldi's Needlework that sells all the Benton and Johnson gold work?
Yes. I have a friend that's ordered from them.
You're just a hoarder, Beth.
I need more time. That's my thought. I need more time. And then seeing all these ideas are popping up with the bird with all the sequins.
Working. There's a great, Jenny has a wonderful YouTube video on how to set up a slate frame. It makes it very easy. So go to YouTube, look for Jenny Adden-Christie slate frame, and you will learn how to set up a slate frame the easy way.
You're looking at two people who have done all that research, and we just simply need to sit down and do it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
On how to do it. So. Yeah.
We had our friend Kathy Andrews actually sit down and show us. She actually put one together.
No, she did yours. She did yours. I put mine together.
Beth put hers together. And then we bought the frames. It's our fault. It's all us. Yeah.
We
just got to do it.
Yeah.
So, all right, tell about this class, because this it looks like it's in a town where we need to have a road trip.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be the most wonderful experience, I think. So I've been hired to teach an embroidery workshop in France, in the town of Provins, P-R-O-V-I-N-S, by Creative Experiences, which many of you may know. It's a wonderful embroidery tourism company based in France. and run by Nadine and Mark Rogers. And so it's going to be a kit based on my Nightbirds embroidery. It's going to take place in April of 2025. Let me look here. I have to look at my dates now. I have to put my glasses on. So it's from April 8th to the 13th in Provence. And we're going to be at a wonderful hotel called the Hotel Au Vieux Rempart. And it's a 4-star hotel in the medieval part of Provence, which is a walled medieval city, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So it's going to be just a spectacular location. And it will be a 4-day embroidery workshop. There are like 6 hours a day, 3 hours in the morning, 3 in the afternoon with a wonderful lunch in between. And the food looks amazing at this place too, by the way. They have a spa. So there are lots of things to do when you're not embroidering. And then it's going to be followed, if you wish, and hopefully everybody will wish, because this is going to be incredible too. We're going to then hop on a train and go up to Paris and spend 3 days in Paris. And the hotel we're staying there at there is called the Ibis Steel Paris Guerre de l'Est Magenta. Okay, I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. But it's near the Gare de l'Est train station in that area in the 10th arrondissement. And so it's going to be 3 days in Paris. This is also a beautiful, very interesting hotel. And we're going to do shopping. And we're going to be hosted there by Rebecca Devaney of Textile Tours of Paris. And she's going to take us around to all the wonderful stores, embroidery and stitching related in Paris. Maybe some flea market, I don't know. But for sure, I think we're going to go to Ultramode, which is, or Ultramode, I'm not sure how you say it. It's been in business since, 1832. It's been in business. So it's,
wow.
It's the oldest haberdashery in Paris. It started as a hat store in the 19th century and now is a haberdashery that sells every kind of incredible thread, embroidery thread, stitching thread, metallic threads. They sell every kind of braid, ribbon, beautiful vintage silk fabrics, buttons. I have no idea what all they have, but it's going to be just like heaven. So that's one of the places we're going to go to. I think we're also going to go to perhaps Mokuba, which is a wonderful ribbon store. They also have beautiful lace trims there. And we are very lucky that we are going to get a special tour of Auvergne-sur-Oise, of the factory. There will also be a shopping. They'll allow everybody to purchase some of their wonderful silks and things. And then the last day of the Paris part, we're going to go to Versailles. And in Versailles, we're going to go to the Musée de la Toile de Joie, which is a museum of toile fabrics, basically. This also was started in 1760 or something. It was 1760, something like that. Anyway, it's been around for a long time.
When you said 1700s, it really doesn't matter.
Started in 1760, but that's when it's based on work from this factory that made the toile fabric that has been there since, well, the 18th century. So we're going to go there. We're also going to visit Maison Sajou, which is one of my favorite embroidery stores, and I order a lot of things from them. I order my filo chinois threads there. You can also get those at Ultramode and other places around, but that's where I tend to order them. I use their metallics a lot in my work. They have all sorts of beautiful tools, embroidery fabric, embroidery threads, beautiful scissors, all kinds of things. And then in the afternoon, after a wonderful lunch someplace, we're going to go to the Chateau de Versailles. So we'll go to the Palace of Versailles and have a wonderful afternoon there. So it's going to be just jam-packed of incredible embroidery-related things in Paris and Versailles. And I think hopefully everybody's going to love the workshop as well. And although I know the kit looks a little bit daunting, I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. It is a high intermediate, probably to advanced level kit. It will be helpful to have some experience with gold work and silk shading, or at least to be an experienced embroiderer. But I'm trying to make it accessible. I hope to share some tips and tricks to make things a little bit easier, that I may do differently from other people. But anyway, we should hopefully have just a wonderful time. I can't wait.
Well, I think sometimes there's not to find a good advance kit too. Sometimes that's hard. You know, there's a lot of beginner or intermediate, but to get something that's a little more advanced that can challenge you, that's nice to have too. You know, especially
I hope so.
Progress. You know,
boy, that is a needleworker dream trip, isn't it? Once in a lifetime.
So.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And then I can see Gary liking that, the medieval town. I did a little research beforehand and I was like, oh, you know, he'll just skip class and he's going to go be biking. That's what he's going to do.
Well, it certainly looks like an incredibly beautiful location. And, Nadine and Mark always find gorgeous locations for their events. Everybody I know that's taught for them, because I know several people that have taught for them and then that we've discussed this, and everybody that's gone, they just say it's just incredible. They just do a beautiful event. And so I think it'll be a really special, special time. And I hope some of you will come. And there are still spaces available. It's limited, but there are still spaces available. So I hope some of you will sign up.
Yeah, we'll have links in the show notes for that. So registration is open now. People can register.
Registration is open. People can sign up now. I think you'll put the website, but it's just creative-experiences.com. So it's creative-experiences.com. Make sure you don't forget the little hyphen in their name. And then if you go to their website, you just go to browse experiences. You can scroll down and find Embroidery with Ann Beck. And there you go. You can sign up directly through the website. If you need help, you can also contact them either by email, or if you go to their contact page, they also have a phone number that you can call and they'll be happy to help you personally sign up. So, as well as answer any questions that you might have.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll put the links in the show notes so that people can check it out. Oh boy, what a trip, huh? Holy smokes.
Yes. And to do the beautiful stitching too. I think that's just a beautiful piece, you know.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it really is. When you go through that process of, all right, you've designed the main piece and now I have to design something that's more approachable for students and that can be taught in a class, is that a tough process? You know, what do I simplify?
Well,
what do I eliminate?
I'll be quite honest, because Nadine asked me specifically for something based on nightbirds. And, it can only be simplified so much and continue to maintain its integrity. So I have not simplified it that much. There are certain things I have changed a little bit. First of all, the little tiny beads that I use are difficult to work with. And because they're vintage, there's no way you can get enough of them to put in, kit, especially if you're going to continue to make and sell the kit down the road. So I did make it slightly larger. The bird is larger than it is in my piece, which will make it a little bit easier to stitch. The beads are slightly larger, although they're still quite small. They're 15-aught beads, size 15, some of them are Japanese beads and some of them are from Preciosa in Czechoslovakia. So they're still small, but they're not as tiny as the little micro beads, and you can use a more reasonable needle to sew them. So making the bird a little bit bigger I did on purpose to make it not quite as hard to sew. And then as I'm currently right now stitching on the kit prototype, I'm trying to take photographs of the steps very well, especially like silk shading. And, I'm going to try to put some of my little tricks that make things easier in the instructions as I write the instruction booklet. So there are a few things that I've changed, but not too much.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to believe that just looking at the pictures that there, you can't do too much or it loses its integrity.
It's beauty. So, you know, I think in the future I may do, I mean, my goal is not to be an embroidery teacher really who teaches beginning embroiderers. There are so many wonderful instructors out there that are already doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm an artist that is getting interested and one of the reasons I'm interested is because I've had so many people request for me, do you have kits? We love your work. How can we do it? And so one would assume that those are already more advanced embroiderers. So I guess my goal is not to make kits for beginners. My goal is to make beautiful kits based on my artwork. Obviously not make them so hard that people can't do them, but you know, that they're beautiful kits for people that will be more intermediate or advanced stitchers.
Well, it seems to me that there's a real niche for that and probably a need, because yeah, you can find beginner level stuff just by showing up in the morning, but to get that more advanced stuff that would really challenge a skilled stitcher or a determined stitcher, not so readily available. So I can see a niche.
I agree, actually. And I rarely do kits, but because I'm usually working on something of my own design, but occasionally you just want to not have to make every decision. And I've done a couple of Jenny Adding Christie's kits, and they're very hard. The ones that I've done, I did the peacock mitten, which I think is probably one of her most difficult kits. And I did the little peacock etui, just for my own pleasure. And I love those kits. I love her work. We sort of correspond every now and then via email. But it is nice to have a kit that, as an advanced or professional stitcher, in my case, that you can occasionally just like say, oh, it's going to be Christmas break. I just want something to embroider that I don't have to like make all the decisions on. You know, and there are some kits out there like that, but not a huge number. So hopefully people will want to do my kit as well. And
yeah. Is that fun once you, at the level that you've operated at and continue to operate at, to have something that really challenges you? Do you just dig right in?
Oh yeah. No, I enjoy it. And you know, when I do somebody else's kit, I can't help but put my little own spin on it. I add some beads or add things or whatever from my own collection. But yes, I enjoy being challenged, and I always learn something new when I do somebody else's work too. You know, as a costume designer, I had my costume shop, and I made, you know, I had a staff, but I can do and make every single thing that I ever designed. And I taught all my workers how to make, you know, there are lots of designers who don't have those skills. I think they're limited without having them, because they're always dependent on other people being able to interpret their work somehow. But it is, oh, I've lost my train of thought a little bit. It is challenging to make other people's designs come to life. But you always learn something. You always learn something, no matter how good you are already. You're always going to learn something new. And I found particularly the peacock mitten really challenging. I probably made it a little harder than it was originally because I changed a few things for my own pleasure. But I enjoy that. And it keeps your mind sharp and it keeps your skill level up.
Isn't that what's important? Is that you be open to learning more and never reach that point where you think.
I think no matter what level you are at, you always can learn something new. Yeah. And I love teaching. I've been teaching in some way for most of my life. And so I hope I can impart some of that knowledge to folks as I begin to teach some workshops. And I probably have some different skills than other people, just because of my background. I don't know all the rules about gold work, for instance. So sometimes I do it differently. I'm like, oh, it's easier this way, you know? So, right. I enjoy learning from others as well as teaching. So,
well, and I got to believe that working in the theater and athletic costume design and construction world, that you talk about the rules, at some point you got to get the thing done. You just don't care what the rules are. You got to get it done. Okay. It's got to function.
Level with the clients that I worked with, that we're not talking, I don't know about rules, but you can't just get it done. It has to be absolutely spectacularly beautiful. It has to be beautifully made. You know, I worked with Olympic champions, world champions. I worked with San Francisco Ballet, which is one of the top ballet companies in the world. They don't take second best.
Right.
You know, so I worked with Brian Boitano. I worked with Christy Yamaguchi. You know, you clients at that level, you have to always do your best. It always has to be the best because that's what they're used to. That's what they expect. And I had a small shop in San Francisco, you know, compared to say some of the really great big costume shops in New York or London or wherever, Los Angeles. But we made some very large shows for our small size and some just spectacularly beautiful things that were as good as anything made anywhere else in the world. And in some cases, I think better because we maybe didn't have as much going on. And I always felt like we had to be the best because I was a smaller shop and I wasn't in New York. So never did I want anybody to come back and say, oh, this doesn't fit right or isn't good enough. You know, I was known for my fit, for the comfort of my costumes. You know, it's horrible to wear an uncomfortable costume or one that doesn't, that rips or comes up your butt or whatever. If you're a dancer or a skater, that's the thing you have to worry about. So the performers loved that my costumes were fit well and were comfortable and they just didn't have to worry about them once they were on stage.
Yeah.
So,
and that's what I meant about the rules is you got to make it, it's got to work. And if there's some, this is the way it's always done. You don't want to hear about it. It's got to function the way that, you know, at the top level. Yeah.
Well, yes. And I think because when I was young, I started doing this when I was very young. I started in the fashion industry when I was in my mid 20s, which is where I learned a lot of my pattern making skills, and beading skills. And then I started working with San Francisco Ballet when I was only 31 years old. And it was terrifying, I have to say, because, you know, I was like, if I fail, okay, I'm never going to get another job in my whole life. And if I fail this first job, they're never going to hire me again. But if I'm successful, then I'll, you know, do really well. So I was successful at the cost of a lot of sleep. I didn't get much sleep on that first job. But one thing that I determined at the beginning of my career, because I was very talented, but I wasn't yet very experienced. And so sometimes I was afraid, to design something that I didn't know how to make. So I'd be like, okay, I have this idea in my head, but I don't know how to sew that yet, or I don't know how to make it. I don't know how, and I'm also a textile artist. I told you all that, but we haven't talked about it yet. So I taught myself to dye fabric and hand paint silk. And because I just had these vivid colors in my mind that I wanted to use. But as I said, at the beginning, I was afraid of failing and afraid of not knowing how to do something. And I finally just said, look, Anne, you got to cut it out. Because if you are always only designing things that you know how to make, you're never, ever going to grow as a designer and you're going to limit yourself. So I just decided from that day on, design whatever I could imagine in my head, and then I would figure out how to make it. Mm-hmm. So I became very creative. Somewhat self-taught in some things. I obviously had quite a bit of training. I was very lucky though. Once I did start working with San Francisco Ballet, they got to know me. And I got to be pretty friendly with the wardrobe department there. They were super helpful to me in letting me look at their costumes. So I could look and see how things were made. And in fact, one summer they let me borrow, I think, 6 of their most beautiful tutus to just take home and study. They were all different from different shops. And it was invaluable to be able to do that kind of research and make notes on those type of, you know, thousands of dollar tutus. And it helped me, but it also helped them because it helped me make the kind of costumes they needed. Anyway,
well, that's the,
don't limit yourself. You can always figure it out.
Right. That's the one big question when we discovered that you've done all this work that I have, and I've had this question 1,000 times. When you see figure skaters, ballet, any of those people who are doing incredible athletic movements, is one of the things I think about is how are these things constructed, these clothes, to hold up? Because you've got I'm sure sweat. I mean, everybody sweats, but the stress that's on the seams and the cloth, is that the primary focus when you're putting these things together, is just make sure they don't come apart?
No, not really. I wouldn't say okay. It was my primary focus, but it is something you have to take into consideration. I made a specialty out of making dance and figure skating costumes. So it became something that I just knew how to do. You have to really understand the movement of the performers. That's one of the most important things. And there are a lot of designers say that if they come from just a fashion background, or even if they just come from a theater background, straight theater, where their actors are working, and then suddenly they're designing costumes for ballet, then they often don't understand that you have to change how things are made, because they have to be comfortable. They have to, not everything is stretchy, but you often put in stretch elements. Figure skating costumes tend to be fairly stretchy through the body usually. But again, then you want to use beautiful silks for the skirts, silk chiffons, little tissue silk chiffons, all sorts of things like that. So you have to also know what kind of partnering, if they're like a para skater or ice dancers, or say if it's going to be a ballet where there's, you know, they're almost always dancing with each other in ballets. What sort of partnering are they doing? You know, they need to be able to lift their arms above their head fully without the whole costume lifting up or the sleeves ripping out. They need to be able to do splits in the air, sometimes more than splits these days, without their pants ripping. The ballerinas, especially in contemporary ballets, are often bare-legged. They don't have any tights on. And in many of the more contemporary choreographers use just like a leotard or a leotard with a little stuff on it. So you can't have a ballerina like suddenly go into a full like split or put her leg all the way up in the air and then the panty is coming up her butt. You know, it's horrible. Right. Yeah. And it's horrible for skaters too. I learned how to cut the leg hole the right size. You make very tight elastics so they can't possibly come up. You make a wider crotch so if they split, you know, you don't see anything. I mean, not if the costume splits, but if the dancer does a split. But yes, you have to take it into account. And then in the good ward, in big companies like San Francisco Ballet or some of the other, any good ballet company, they have a great wardrobe department usually that knows also how to care for the things. So one of the most important things is caring for the fabric so that the sweat doesn't stay there. They get cleaned, they get steamed, they get rinsed out. Also with soaps and things that don't damage the fabric farther. Most fabrics in theater and ballet, and a lot in figure skating as well, are dyed. You know, I certainly used almost exclusively hand dyed and painted fabrics in my work, unless the budget just simply didn't allow it, which is occasionally the case. But certainly for a company like San Francisco Ballet, you're dyeing fabrics all the time, and they're very expensive once they're dyed. Also digitally printing fabrics, which is very, very, you know, the fabric, by the time the artwork's done and the thing is printed, it could be over $200 a yard for some tissue silk chiffon that, you know, what if it rips? You know, so I always had to remind my stitchers, it's better for the seam to rip than the fabric to rip. So people often think you want to weld those seams shut, but actually you don't. You want to cut the pattern so that it won't split in the first place, because there's like a gusset in the crotch or under the arms or wherever. But then when you stitch it, for instance, if you're stitching a beautiful silk skirt onto a leotard or a bodice of some type, even if it's a shorter skirt, often now dancers will be on the floor as part of their choreography. It's very easy for somebody to step on your skirt and you're getting up, and then what if it rips? So you'd rather have the skirt actually rip off the bodice than for the fabric to rip away. So you nice. Want the thread that you sewed it on with. We use cotton, not polyester usually, so that the thread would rip. And we used a larger stitch than, you know, not a super teeny tiny stitch where you would weld it, because then the silk will rip. And it's much harder to repair than if the skirt just pulls away from the costume itself. The other thing you have to think of is weight. If you design for opera, it doesn't, I mean, obviously you have different things for singers, but especially for, say, like somebody's the king or whatever, and he's not a singing role, it's a supernumerary role. They can have a heavy old robe that's like super heavy and made out of heavy brocade. In ballet, say a ballet like Romeo and Juliet or Sleeping Beauty or something where they're kings and queens, those people have to dance. And even if they're not like Juliet or Romeo, even if they're not the main character, they still have to move and dance. And so in order to make that opulent look, you often will use something like a silk cut velvet instead of a brocade that's been painted or dyed, or laces, which are, they're lightweight fabrics that can be made to look very opulent and more heavily constructed, but they're still lightweight.
See, that's that's what fascinates me. The knowledge you have to have on so many fronts to make that happen. That is just, it's just fascinating.
Right. And so the fabric not ripping, I never thought of that. I really thought, well, they've got to sew it really well so it stays together.
Well, but it should be sewn well so that it stays together, but if your silk skirt is made out of a digitally printed fabric that's $200 a yard, you really don't want the silk to rip. You want, you know, because it's not going to completely come off. You know, there'll be a little pull away if somebody steps on it. So it probably won't interfere with the performance. I mean, luckily I never had a costume rip during performance, but these things happen occasionally, you know, and I've seen some things happen sometimes. And I was like, oh my God, I feel bad. I have a funny story about San Francisco Ballet's Romeo and Juliet when they first, which I didn't work on that production at all, but I was there on the opening night, and I was already working with them when that ballet premiered, which was, you know, really, really long time. I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, something like that. It was designed by Jens Jakob Forsa, who was, I think, a Danish designer, one of my favorite designers in the world, who sadly now passed away. But he did the most beautiful, opulent looking designs that he used various lightweight silks and ribbons and all things that were sewn together. And on Romeo and Juliet, every end of every cord had a filigree gold tassel on it, like tassel end on it. All the beads were filigree. There were lots of laces being used. And then I went to the opening night, and there's a scene at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet where Juliet is in the bedroom with her nurse, and, you know, they're having a happy dance or whatever. And they dance around a little bit, and then they go off their own way. And they kept dancing around in a circle, hugging each other, and kept dancing around in a circle. And I'm like, what in the world is going on up there? I can't, this isn't the choreography. I'm like, what are they doing? And it was Joanna Behrman, who was a beautiful principal dancer back in the day. She's long retired from performing. And I think it was Anita Pachotti, who was also a dancer, is now a character dancer with San Francisco Ballet. And they had gotten stuck together because the filigree buttons had stuck to the lace on Juliet's dress, and they couldn't get apart. Anyway, they finally got apart and continued on. And so the poor wardrobe department at San Francisco Ballet had to put clear, they just used clear packing tape, I think, over every single piece of filigree on every single costume so that wouldn't happen again.
Oh, yeah, no. But who knew?
I wouldn't have thought of that. The poor designer hadn't thought of it. It hadn't happened in rehearsal. Nobody thought of it. And then boom, opening night, and they're stuck together. So, you know,
this was opening night. This happens. Oh, geez.
Nobody in the audience noticed. Didn't go on as that long. But I knew the ballet, and I'm like, what are they doing? So I don't think anybody, regular audience goers, noticed, but I did. So anyway,
That's funny.
When a performance ends, do they have staff that goes through all the costumes to make sure that they don't need repair? Do you get called in for that kind of work?
No. Yes, they have staff. No, I don't get called, or I didn't get called. The the costume shop's job pretty much ends on opening night, or the designer's job doesn't always end on opening night. I mean, occasionally, especially on a really large, like a full length ballet, there'll be changes made for some time. There can be anyway. But in general, the wardrobe staff takes over any care or repair of the costumes once the ballet is up and running. And figure skating shows have wardrobe staff too. It's not as good as what you get at a big ballet company where you have people that's all they do. I didn't generally get called back for anything. I mean, if something happens on a dress rehearsal or like tech rehearsal, yeah, then it would depend. If it was just like the dancer stepped on it and it ripped, probably the wardrobe department will fix it. If it's the choreographer decides all the necklines need to be a half inch shorter and it's the tech rehearsal, well, then I have to keep a crew overnight, you know, until it's done, and, you know, it costs them a whole lot of money to have me fix it. And then, you know, occasionally there are things that we would do together. So,
and therein lies the stress of the job right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Oh,
What's tougher to design, figure skating or ballet, or doesn't matter?
I think they're just slightly different. With figure skaters, you're designing for that particular performer or set of performers. With ballet, you're designing for the choreographer. Is the person that is who you have to design for, or who sets the parameters, because it's his or her ballet. The ballet company may have some input in it, but particularly if it's budgetary wise, if the choreographer wants something that's just too expensive, then we all sort of have a meeting like, well, what can we change? What, you know, how can we fit within the budget? You know, they're slightly different parameters. They're more, I would say that figure skating costumes tend to be more heavily beaded. With, for instance, back in the day, I would be using Swarovski crystals. Because to have it show on television, if they're going to be on television, you have to put a whole lot more bling on there. Because it just, the way the lighting is and the way the film, the video or digital cameras pick it up, it's just different than on stage. You also have to use slightly different colors. In stage, you can use beautiful, like say you could do a whole thing that was like muted greens and browns and beautiful earth tones. That would just look like horrible on television. You need to use brighter colors. Mm-hmm. It's not the same. So I don't know. I enjoyed doing both. I loved working with all the performers. I loved working with the figure skaters that I worked with. And then you're just working on one set of costumes. It's not like 40 costumes.
Right. Yeah.
So, you can put a lot more into each costume, perhaps, than if you're doing a big ballet or even a contemporary ballet at a large company. They'll get like double set of costumes or something. So,
yeah. Do you miss it?
There are certain things about it I miss. I don't miss the stress. I'm filling my creative void with my embroidery. So I still am very, very creative and artistic. I'm an artist. I would say one of the things that I miss the most is being in a big opera house, watching friends, you know, a big company perform for you, and there are like four of you in the house, and they're having like, you know, the orchestra rehearsal, and it's just like, it's amazing. I mean, to be in the San Francisco Opera House when there's just the design staff and the technical staff and a few dancers around the sprinkled about the audience, and you're watching this spectacular company and dancers perform. And the energy's a little bit different than a performance, but not much. So I miss that sometimes. But I still go to the ballet. I mean, I still buy a ticket and go. I enjoy it. I love it. That's the only thing I miss, really, you know, and probably working with the performance. I love working with the performance. So. Yeah.
Okay. So that means you took it all the way to the hilt and. You got your satisfaction out of it all the way. Okay.
Pretty much. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Well, Anne, what a treat. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been so much fun, and I appreciate it so much.
Yep. Well, we have enjoyed it. One more time now, the class is coming up that people need to sign up for.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So if you go to creative-experiences.com, you can find a link to my, you just go to browse experiences, scroll down until you come to Embroidery with Ann Beck, and that'll take you to my Nightbirds workshop, and you can sign up. Again, in France in April of 2025, so about 8 months from now, and we're going to have a wonderful time. We're going to do a lot of beautiful embroidery and then some wonderful shopping so in Paris.
Yep.
So,
yep. Excellent. Thanks, Ann. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you both. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it.
Yep. And thanks to everyone for listening.